Welcome to the Good Reading Podcast, proudly sponsored by Book People Gift Cards. A Book People gift card is the perfect gift for readers of all ages. Simply order your gift card online at bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au. Redeem at any one of over 500 bookshops across Australia. Visit bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au.
Six. Reflective. A flatness meeting itself in the mirror sees everything.
Nam Lee's poetry has been published in The Monthly, The Paris Review, The American Poetry Review, Bomb, Conjunctions, and The Boston Review. His short story collection, The Boat, was the recipient of numerous awards, including the Australian Prime Minister's Literary Award, the Melbourne Prize for Literature, and the Dylan Thomas Prize. Today I'm talking to Nam Lee about his first book of poetry, 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem. Nam Lee, welcome to the Good Reading Podcast.
Thanks, Greg, for having me.
In the introduction, I referred to 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem as a book of poetry rather than a collection. It's not merely a random collection of disparate parts, but a sequence, even a novel. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much a book of poetry. It's also a book-length poem. It's one poem that is made up of a bunch of other standalone poems, but none of those standalone poems actually exists in isolation. They need the other poems to sort of bump up against them and to revise and reprism what your first read or apprehension of a poem might be.
And it's now some 16 years since you published the multi-award winning The Boat, which might be more fairly described as a collection of short stories. Is there any common ground between The Boat and this work, 36 Ways?
Yeah, absolutely. Looking back now, I can see a lot of things. And one of the things I see is that in the collection of stories, The Boat, I had happened upon a structure that felt as though it was containing and not compromising my contradictions and my variousnesses, with the stories diverging so much in terms of everything, in terms of voice and subject matter and setting and style. And I needed that in order to sort of create a field of tension, I want to say, between the stories, so that what harmonics, I guess, were sort of brought up by reading those stories existed in a way that was outside of the stories and partook of the stories as a whole. And this is exactly the same sort of structure and mode, I guess, as this book uses to create meaning and to create mystery as well.
I wonder what brought your focus to poetry, and then again, what can poetry articulate that your prose can't?
I started in poetry. There was a stage, quite a long stage, where I was that dude, you know, who only read poetry and wrote poetry, and most of it was pretty bad. In a way, it was prose that was the waylay, you know, the excursion into something else. And it's been quite a prolonged one, I guess. Part of the reason, again, that it's taken me this time to come out with this book is because through the intervening years in which I've never stopped writing, I haven't felt as though the prose that I'd been writing and I'd read back over was actually expressing how I felt or who I was in the fullest way that I would like. There is a clarity or a coherence that prose insists upon. It's often communicated via a series of moves and devices and masteries that come across as authority. And so you sort of, in a way, fake it till you make it almost. And once you have that authority, you don't want to sort of waste it on things that aren't clear or certain or marshaled and, you know, directed. And for me, that sense of clarity or coherence wasn't what was going through my head and what I was looking for when I was reading stuff that really resonated with me. It was almost as though I sounded like I knew what I was talking about when I was writing prose. And I didn't feel that way in my life and in my work and in my art. And what I was looking for was a way of expressing all of these things with an equal intensity and integrity toward language, an equal commitment to articulating something in the best way possible, but also a commitment to not knowing, to not being sure, to being in a state of negative capability, you know, to being irresolved and unresolved, and to leaving things insoluble and bumping up against each other in, you know, in weird ways and having them be asymmetric. And that feels more like it's in line with where I am and how I am. And so I guess in poetry, to be super long-winded, it's a way, it's a structure, a shape that allows me to preserve these ambiguities in a way that feels truthful rather than just, you know, abstruse or withholding.
As I read these poems, take away one interpretation from the first reading, but a different one on the second reading. And one of the powerful themes is this one of identity, more specifically, an exploration of, I suppose, this irreconcilable double bind of the experience of living in Australia as a man with Vietnamese heritage. Are we looking here at affirmation, at rejection, ownership of heritage, or perhaps something more like catharsis?
I think, Greg, that it's everything. I love what you're saying about your experience reading the poem and sort of coming to one stance or understanding and then sort of moving along and then sort of seeing the first thing in a different way and being, you know, reprismed in a sense, or reset or revised. I love that because that to me is the whole difficulty and dream and intent of this book. To me, certainty, coherence, knowing what you're saying, knowing how you're meant to feel or make the other person feel can veer really closely to piety or to programmatic thinking. And I think we've got too much piety and programmatic thinking around us right now. And I think that what I was trying to do that felt real and right and true to me was create something which is not a thing. It's not an answer. It's a process. It's a questioning. And so to hear your experience makes me really, really happy because that's exactly what I want. I want people to sort of to wander through these poems and to be a little bit unsettled and destabilized. You know, I would like them to think, ah, oh, I've got it. I've caught it. I understand it. The tone, the attitude, the register, the message, whatever it is. And then to sort of move on and then see and understand, oh, maybe that was not exactly right, or maybe I've been trapdoored here, or maybe it's both things at the same time. And then to keep on moving on from that position, find a new position, a new stance, a new vantage, and then sort of see and understand there's another aspect to this, or that there is another depth to this, or a difference. And that feeling of being constantly de-resolving, re-resolving, unsettled, resettled, that process of discovery and in some ways discomfort, is it's an enactment of what I'm trying to do. You know, as the title says, it's 36 ways of writing a Vietnamese poem. And it's complex because it's, as you say, it's a bind. It's a double, triple, quadruple, it's an infinite bind. And there's nothing that you can do that actually escapes those binds. And so all you can do, I think, is be open about them and look them square on and then sort of shuffle to the side and look them side on and then shuffle to the side and look them, you know, elliptically or from a different dimension and just be as engaged with the difficulty and the complexity of what it means to, you know, have an identity and express that identity and have that identity play out in certain contexts and ways. It is meant to be unresolved and unresolvable. And I think that's part of the dissatisfaction of the question of identity, if you think of it as something that needs to be solved.
On that point, I've got to refer to number 20, titrative or titration, commonly used in the laboratory as a method of quantitative chemical analysis, an even more interesting word in the context of this book in regard to ethnicity or the amount of ethnicity. And I think that's one of the things you're grappling with. It's a very short one. I can read it myself in just a few seconds. Number 20, titrative, unself consciously, ha ha. Too late. Now, this one is more playful than most, if not light-hearted, I suppose. There's that very interesting thing about how Vietnamese are you? How Australian are you?
It's a poem that, again, sort of works on different frequencies, and that frequency is one that is pulsing with prominence. And of course, it sort of links to really kind of scary and problematic assays and concerns about blood quanta and classifications and taxonomies, and are you in this class, or harking back to Linnaeus, in that subspecies. That's definitely one of the allusions of that poem. And I think, to me, titration is really interesting because it seeks through accretion or through trial and error, let's say, to pinpoint that exact moment when something changes, and the change can be quite dramatic. And if you've done it in, in science class, you're sort of dropping some reagent into a solution, and the moment of titration is when, let's say saturation has been affected, and then the solution just might change its state or character completely. I'm sure if there are scientists out there listening to this, they'll be like, that is not what titration is, and I apologize. But my metaphorical understanding of it was very much, the idea that you can be doing something accretively, assiduously, in tiny, tiny increments, and nothing seems to change. And then you hit that one moment and everything changes. And to me, it's a trap and a permission. Like when you relate it to identity, or when you relate it to wherever you want to draw the line, whether it's nationality or citizenship or sense of belonging or home ownership or blood quanta, legal definitions, there is a sense that that moment is constantly close, and you're never quite ready for it, and you're always surprised when it comes. And I think for me, the nerdy sort of frequency on which I sort of most relate to this poem is about self-consciousness, which I would say is almost the same thing as consciousness. And I think that self-consciousness has gotten a really bad rap. I think people have been taught or led to feel that something which is conscious of itself and of its own biases and machinations is somehow lesser than the full thing itself. And to me, the full thing itself, moments of transcendence, of sublimity, of total loss of self, or whatever you want to call it, it degrades those moments, which, in my experience and talking to other people and reading other people, are meant to be rare. And they're meant to be rare for a reason. Like, they're meant to be epiphanic, they're meant to be transcendent. And yet we live in a world of advertising, let's be honest. And these moments are now just category C in how to move someone to consume something. And I think we've been degraded in that sense. And so we think of, it's the same thing as before. We think of things that are pure, that are unadulterated, that are full streamed, as being realer and more authentic and better than other things. And I think that this is a really dangerous idea. And I think when you relate it to identity, especially, it's an extraordinarily dangerous idea. This idea that, if you have any sort of questions or doubts or sense of idiosyncrasy about how you come at identity and what it means to you, then you are somehow not fully that thing, or somehow suspect. Number 11, violence, Anglo-linguistic. Appetitive, omnivorous, expansionary, atonal, with smashed together consonants, it wants it all. Empire and industry, science, technology, narratology, transaction. One language to rule them all. Billions strong. The standard, the first and first second, mitotic, mitogenic, mitochondrial. Ceaselessly dividing, changing, charging, it incorporates all, exiles all. We become internal emigres, exophones. Our tongue, blood glutted, rapined, chrismed in Rome, hardened in old Germanic mouths, totalized. Bonded now to long Western bent, Western lexicology, logorrhea, lexithymia, Western grammar.
Poetry can have weight. Verse can be light, even light-hearted, but also heavy. And that one It's like dropping a burden on the reader, and that burden varies according to background. And it stood out to me. It's the imperialism of English language. And I felt the tables had been turned on me on that one, as if I'd been sliced through with a sharp object, and that my language was imperial.
Yeah, what I would say is the slice goes even deeper through me when I'm writing that. It's very much a self-directed slice, but you know, it's going in every direction. And basically what I'm saying is language is not neutral. Language has a history. Language has an intention. In fact, you know, language was actually invented to keep account of surplus grain and supplies and slaves, you know, and then it was used to keep people in line, you know, through the word of God. It's a thing that is steeped in violence. You know, I think there's a quote by Walter Benjamin where he says that there is no document of civilization that is not also a document of barbarism. And I think this doesn't even speak to the notion of violence within the language, the records of conquest and colonialism and imperialism, as you say, and the way that even within languages, the way that a language evolves is through violence. It's through miscegenation. It's through theft. It's through appropriation, and it's through erasure. So, I sometimes look at a book or a dictionary, and I think this is an archive of violence in a sense, like it is a site of massacre, you know, and it is all corruption. So that's one point of view. But the other point of view, which I try to bring up in that poem too, is that violence is also the source of everything. When mitosis happens and a cell is cleaved in half, that's about as violent a thing as you can imagine, both metaphorically and you know, in terms of what is. And yet that is the only way in which we grow and develop and evolve as well. I love that language can absorb and corrupt, you know, if you were to use that metaphor, or mutate. I love that language is so capacious that it can actually accommodate the consciousnesses of those people that it has potentially historically oppressed. I love that it is open to meanings that are not always apparent on the surface of things. And to me, I think it's the best thing that we have. The possibilities that are figured and figurable in language are, to me, the closest thing that we have to, you know, being godlike. And so, yes, it's violent, but it's also generative. Things are at odds, they're tense, they're disputatious, but you know, as Heraclitus says, all things take place by strife.
And you use the term erasive, and there's clearly a connection with number 26, erasive, which I tried desperately but unsuccessfully to read, a 100% redacted verse. But I gather that's the whole point of this poem, erasive.
There are different forms and there are different degrees of erasure, aren't there? And you know, there's the obvious top-down imposed ideological, maybe state-imposed erasure or redaction or censorship. There's the erasure or censorship that we impose upon ourselves, or our imperfect and aging and degenerating bodies impose upon us, vis-a-vis our memories that are, in my case anyway, extremely fallible and getting worse. And there are also the erasures that just take place through the sheer effluxion and action of time. The things that are in the grayed out text in that poem are some of the documents in which some histories might still be accessible. Those histories are becoming less and less accessible, not necessarily because we can't get to them, but because the impetus, the drive, the intention to get to them, I think, has been dissipating for some time. So much of the records of the past are now weaponized and instrumentalized in the service of this or that culture war, let's say. And time also has a way of eroding pretty much everything. And so that too is an act of erasure, which I happen to think is, it's the thing, it's the prod that leads to ethical consideration, you know, knowing that all this is impermanent, knowing that we're going to crack it, knowing that nothing will hold, no archive holds, nothing is forever, even plastic, let's say, and yet trying to figure out a way to live and communicate and to act decently is, it's basically the bedrock of ethical an ethical life, I think. So erasure is a term that is used in all of its valencies in that regard, and it figures language as something which both resists erasure or deletion or forgetting, but it also is very much the agent of that forgetting as well, whether it's through deliberate action or through neglect.
We've been using some very specialized terminology in this conversation, and that's used throughout this work. And for many, including me, a dictionary by your side will be essential. I wondered, is there a danger of taking the reader out of the experience of reading, even if temporarily? Or do you value the process of thinking more than the fluency of reading?
I don't know. I want there to be no condescension in how I write, and I want there to be no condescension in how I think about who's reading or how my readers are reading as well. I want there to be a full-bodied, full-minded offering. And because, as you say, the book is about language as well, through language and using the various energies and potentialities of language, it would be remiss of me to not include, the full array of language that informs this drive of mine to investigate this stuff. So, in part, I would rather err on the side of sharing with readers the delight that I feel in language, and that particular delight when you find the right word. And the right word for me usually is the one that has multiple meanings and multiple registers, so that they can sort of ring in different ways on different levels. I don't know that fluency is the most important consideration for me in writing or reading. I think there is obviously a place for it, and if you can't marshal or you don't respect the need, the body's need, frankly, for rhythm and fluency and suspension, then you're not gonna get very far. But by the same token, there's a reason why poets for the longest time in English were working in the iamb, in blank verse, let's say, were constantly finding ways to disrupt and subvert and twist the feet of those iambs. So you've got like all these different devices that mess with the rhythm. And I think that messing with the rhythm is actually really, really, really crucial in both reading and writing. People need to sort of be shaken out of what might otherwise be a very easy and effortless sort of glide into passivity, and I think that reading that's active, that asks the readers to really participate, is a stronger kind of reading. The last thing I'd say to that is what we were talking about before in terms of self-consciousness. I think sometimes we think that the highest good a book can do is suspend the reader such that they're no longer reading a book, that they're just in the story and carried away. And I think there's definitely a place for that. But I would argue that the book that asks readers to remember that they're reading a book that is inscribed in language and that is an arrangement of these things put together in a way that is doing something different and new, and comparing it to the way in which language is otherwise degraded in the public discourse or through advertising or politics or whatever, I think that's a really, it's a really good thing and can actually add to the experience of reading as well.
Now, this book is called 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem, but there are actually 37 poems. Number 37, post-racial, glacial. Do I detect a degree of hope for the future, even if we may move at a glacial pace?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. When I was writing the stories in the boat, especially the first story that was dealing with some of these issues of identity and authenticity, and how it's co-opted, by the ecosystem around it, I did feel optimistic then that we were coming to a kind of terms with these things. And if you had told me then that, 10, 20 years on, we would not be in a better place. Our terms would not have been settled, and in many regards, we're in a worse place on these issues and these questions, and more divided than before. I would have been stunned. I would have been very surprised. So, I guess my optimism is a perennial affliction, and I am optimistic. And at the end of that poem, which takes place in a landscape that is completely stark and bereft of life, but is also breathtaking and full of process and beauty. At the end of that poem, with the time compressed, when some life does appear, the orcs appear, and the grouse, that to me is a real symbol of hope.
I've been talking to Nam Le about his first book of poetry, 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem. It's published by Scribner, and you can find it at goodreadingmagazine.com.au. My name's Greg Dobbs, and thanks for listening. This Good Reading podcast was brought to you by Book People Gift Cards. Share the joy of reading with a Book People gift card. To find out more, visit bookpeoplegiftcards.org.au.